Hi, I'm Alex Stonehouse, the host of Decisions That Matter, and on this episode I sat down with the smart and talented Judy Smith to discuss procurement in higher education. Judy has an impressive background in both healthcare and higher education, and she served as the Director of Procurement at the University of Michigan, where she worked for nearly 10 years. We dove into the main differences between purchasing for colleges and universities compared to state and local government procurement, how higher education is handling the pandemic, and the warehousing issues that were caused by the PPE shortage earlier this year. And Judy also shares advice for up-and-coming procurement leaders to help them learn and grow in a positive way. This episode is brought to you by Procurated, the leading supplier evaluation platform for procurement professionals across the U.S. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to the Decisions That Matter podcast, where we meet with leaders from across the procurement community to discuss innovative and strategic ideas. Because when it comes to procurement, every decision matters. Welcome to Decisions That Matter. Today I'm joined by Judy Smith. Thank you for joining me today, Judy.
Thanks for having me.
For those out there that don't know you as well as I do, can you give everybody a background of how you got started in procurement and what your journey has been like so far?
Well, funny enough, I actually wanted to major in materials logistics management at Michigan State whenever I went to college. And my father was a steel buyer for Ford Motor Company. And he was like, absolutely not. You cannot go into procurement. I don't want you to do that. So I majored in human resources. And after that, after undergrad, I went to graduate school and got a master's degree in healthcare administration. I ended up in the Navy. My first day in the Navy, the captain that was standing duty that day and checked me in said, I have not had an ensign in the warehouse in 11 years. So you're going to go to the warehouse and work in supply chain. And so I ended up there and I never left. Just fell in love with it. And my father, much to his chagrin, I ended up right in procurement where he didn't want me.
I actually didn't know the Navy part. And it's funny because I've done a couple of these before. And some people, their answer is something along the lines of, well, it fits my personality or I tried it and I was good at it. Some people are like, I have no idea. I'm here and I'm doing my best. So yours is a mix of both, or it was in your destiny maybe, but also some things fell into place.
Right.
What was your position at the University of Michigan?
I was a director of procurement, stores, and auxiliary services. So I had all the procurement accounts payable, a warehouse, and print copy mail, as well as travel.
Or what percentage of the school budget would you say is coming through your office in that role?
You know, I would guess at the time it was probably about 30% or so. Our spend was $1.4 billion. Since I left like 10 years ago, I think it's tripled in size. So pretty huge growth in those 10 years, but it was a pretty sizable spend.
And would you say the majority of the work that you and your team did on a day-to-day basis was working directly with suppliers, working with the internal stakeholders at the university, or just a combination of both?
You know, a combination of both. We, of course, had tons of transactional work coming through our shop, and in accounts payable, it was, you know, a lot of transactional activity. But I had a strategic sourcing group, which was sort of, at the time, rather new in higher ed. Higher ed's been dabbling in strategic sourcing since the late 90s, but Michigan at the time was sort of a leader in the pack for that group, I dare say. And that group, those few people that did strategic sourcing and electronic invoicing and e-procurement, had a lot of contact with suppliers, and we did a lot of supplier management.
It's been fascinating for me to watch everything that's been happening with Michigan, but the Big Ten in general, with all of the sports stuff that's been happening this fall with football and the season being canceled and then them bringing it back. As they were bringing back Wisconsin football, they're canceling school for students.
Right.
So it's all over the place. What would you say? So in your role with Government Sourcing Solutions, you've had pleasure to talk to, I think, probably hundreds of different universities and colleges at this point over the last several years. What are some of the things that stand out to you as being noteworthy in the sense that they're significantly different than issues that procurement folks in state and local governments might be facing? And what areas might be surprisingly similar?
Right. So I think probably the biggest difference is the whole decentralized aspect of higher ed. And I don't know that I appreciated that term because I was among it and in it. until I worked more closely with folks who were at the state, which is run more like a business would be run, in that not everybody can create a purchase order. In higher ed, we actually give a lot of autonomy to people out in the units and stakeholders to actually create purchase orders, particularly under certain dollar values. And that's going to be dependent on the school, whatever they've established as their policy. But for instance, there are many universities that use $10,000 as the bid limit. And what that means is that the end user can actually create a PO in a procurement system and send it to a supplier without ever coming to procurement. So procurement ends up touching really the big transactions and less of the little ones. One of the reasons higher ed's been able to do that more easily is with e-procurement. So there's a lot of suppliers that have an established relationship, and those transactions, while they are being released by the end user, have really been under sort of an umbrella contract that's been established by the procurement department. And so I think that's why there's such this ability to decentralize operations. And I think that's probably the fundamental difference between state and local government. And it's really university dependent on how much force and respect the procurement department has. I wish you could say like all Big Ten schools have this, you know, this frame, or all private schools look like this, but it is all over the board. Just very dependent on the leadership in the organization and if they've embraced the notion of giving procurement a seat at the table.
One thing that multiple people have mentioned is the point of confusion for the end user. Right. The only time it really pops up is when in their head, the like head of procurement is just the person who runs procurement for the art department, or who runs procurement for the athletic department. Right. So they're used to being able to get pretty much everything under that 10K threshold. And then on the occasion where they need something for 100 grand, and then the person says, well, it's with procurement. They're like, wait, I thought you were procurement. Like, right. That confusion of who's who's.
For sure, for sure. Yeah, one of the things you see a lot in higher ed is that the departments will have somebody that's their buyer, quote unquote. And technically, they don't typically have signature authority, but I guarantee that everybody in the medical school is going to say, well, so-and-so's my buyer. And I bet their card even says buyer on it. But I bet you they don't have a signature delegation in most cases. It's just one of those things that occurs in higher ed, because there's a lot of activity that you don't necessarily want to have the faculty and staff spending their time on. So somebody needs to sort of rein it in, but how it's done is going to be very different.
I know different states, obviously, throughout the country have different laws about going back to school physically or having every school in the state be remote. And then a lot of them have some type of mixture where some classes that need to be in person can be, but some that don't need to are being done digitally. Is there any major themes or threads you've seen in your recent conversations?
So what I'm hearing mostly is that these universities have relied upon their longstanding relationships to buy PPE. At the beginning of the pandemic, there were lots of small suppliers cropping up and some people got burned. And so they are really reaching into those and leaning into those relationships where they have a longstanding relationship. I would say what I'm hearing is vastly different from region of the country, size of school, and ability to do testing on their own. So for instance, there are some schools like in New York, upstate New York, who actually have done rigorous testing. And so they actually tested all the kids before they came back to school. They periodically test them. And it's because they're able to do the rapid testing themselves. Their university is actually doing it for them. Other schools, for instance, I can reference Michigan State. My kid goes there and they really have done no in-person learning. It's all remote. They aren't doing any testing of students because they discouraged kids coming back to campus. And yet they're bringing the football team back, as you mentioned a few minutes ago. And so I think that they've done pretty well in keeping things under control, given the sheer size of that student body. And the fact that a lot of kids that live, quote unquote, off campus have gone back to East Lansing. So I think overall they've done very well in managing what's going on, because young people like to congregate. But it really gets back to getting those young people to do the right thing. The school can do all the right things, and if outside of class those kids don't do what they're supposed to do, we're going to have these problems that, you know, that crop up here and there.
So the trend over the last decade or so has been moving to the sort of immediate delivery model, where you get stuff when you need it, which I think makes total sense and is good advice for still a lot of things that people would need to purchase. we saw when the pandemic hit and people were trying to gather masks and things like that, that there were definitely some people who wished for those specific items that they had had a little bit of a stockpile potentially. But I think what we heard from some people was they just to prepare for worst case scenario in April, May, June, they went out and bought as much PPE as they could. Right. And they were buying toilet paper and they were buying all kinds of stuff. And some of them, especially places where they haven't actually come back to campus, they're actually now in a position where they're like, all right, how do I offload three quarters of this stuff? Because we actually went too far in that direction. Is there a point where a lot of places are, you think, reaching that equilibrium, or have people kind of figured that out over the last 6 months or so?
Well, I think at the beginning of the pandemic, I would have told you that, oh my gosh, we're going to see this surge of people thinking they need a warehouse again. I think folks have calmed down some. In the early 2000s, higher ed went on this sort of barrage of, do we really need warehouses and should we be closing these down? Some larger campuses are looking at cross-docking facilities and things to really slow the truck traffic on campus and just to make it safer for students. And so you do see some campuses really going back toward a model of maybe not so much giant warehousing, but definitely cross-docking and trying to get, you know, consolidated deliveries to campus. Mm-hmm. And maybe be able to take deliveries less frequently as well, right? Just to kind of change their carbon footprint. But I will tell you that I've spoke with a lot of people who have all this stuff that they ordered and came in and is sitting, and they don't really have an inventory system to manage it, nor do they have the ability to store it in a way that it's going to continue to be sterile and all the things that you'd want it to be, right, and easy to access. So it would not surprise me if some of their suppliers are looked at to say, hey, can you buy this back from me and redistribute it? Frankly, if I was in a position where we didn't have a warehouse anymore, I would look to my supplier for help with that. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, that is generally the fallback plan, which works, providing there's not a worldwide pandemic. And so we're kind of in this rock and a hard place at the moment. I know that a lot of universities have looked toward their facilities departments as well for assistance with storing and distribution of items. And so people are managing it. I think the knee jerk of thinking, oh, we're gonna have to have this stuff in stock all the time has calmed down significantly, but it's definitely something that caused everybody pause at the beginning of this.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it seems like it could potentially be sort of a push to get people to plan ahead and plan to work together. Cause I could see a world where you have one university saying, hey, we're fully stocked on this one thing. Right. It'd be enough to cover one of us or both of us in case of an emergency. I know you're fully stocked on this other supply. So,
yeah,
especially if you're far enough apart that a breakout probably wouldn't hit both of you at the same time.
Right.
I could see that working for universities. I could see that also working for states or cities or things like that.
Right.
Like you could see a world where like San Diego and Los Angeles have a partnership where it's like, all right, if it's bad by you, we'll ship some stuff up. If it's bad by us, ship some stuff down.
And frankly, hospitals do that. Hospitals work sort of casually with one another on, you know, issues just like that. It's always been sort of a gentleman's network in hospitals that, you know, when there's a shortage, they do share typically. Not for free. They figure out ways to pay each other. But
when you need stuff, you're willing to pay that little premium there. Do you have any advice or thoughts for people who might be earlier on in their procurement career, things to look out for, things to keep in mind or try to follow?
So I would say where I learned the most was actually just diving in and doing projects, implement stuff. Don't be afraid of failing. Of course, you have to have a really good boss to make sure that they will allow you that ability to fail a little bit. But I think just sort of being a sponge and stepping forward and trying to take in as much as you can whenever you're around people that have implemented something before and trying to dig in and learn it, and don't be afraid to sort of push those boundaries. I know that in procurement, we often think that our suppliers are really just there to sell us something and they're not really there to improve anything. And I disagree with that. I think that you have to really listen to what suppliers are bringing to you, because they survive based on their ability to drive value. And so you have to, of course, be choosy on which suppliers you work with. And I'm not saying to go in blindly, but listen to the ideas that they have, because that's what they're doing, is they're trying to come up with innovative ideas to help improve things and make change. And I think that's the key, is really just reach in and do it. Don't be afraid to implement. And probably the key in those implementations is really grabbing your stakeholders and bringing them into the process and getting them up to speed with why you might do this differently and the benefit to them.
Yeah, that's great advice. That combination of the communication and then actually executing it is huge. And I think too, in a lot of the work that we've done recently with suppliers, is you see that they're not trying to, for the most part, they're not trying to pull a fast one on you and like get one sale for 2020 and then they're gonna dip out and be like, hey, I got X amount of money. Their ideal situation is they get the deal, the contract, they do a good job, it gets renewed, or they are right. working with you for the next 25 years. So they're invested in trying to build that relationship too. Keeping that in mind, it just makes that whole interaction so much easier for both.
And folks, I would encourage people to take advantage of professional organizations like NAEP in higher ed or NIGPA or NASPO. You can learn so much from your peers and really just, you know, attending those things, do presentations at them, give back to the community. It's an amazing network of people. And that is something that is, I think, super unique to higher ed and probably state and local as well, where it's an extremely collegial environment and people like to share what they've learned and what they've done. And you can gain so much from that.
You can be like geographically separated by a lot or have different titles or things like that. But a lot of the issues or a lot of the big wins and things like that are pretty common across the board. So you can find people who can relate to almost your exact scenario right. a lot of times. Sure. So speaking of networking and that kind of career building, is there anybody who you've worked with, either a peer or a manager or somebody like that over the last, over your career, who you would like to mention or shout out or tell a story about?
You know, there are so many people that had such a huge influence on me and really my career path. And probably the key, like three or four, I would say, is my commander, Rod Cadabe, by far, pushed me and gave me opportunity that I think young people in the Navy are not often given. I attended any training that he could find and send me to and ended up just learning so much there. Probably next would be Phil Abruzzi, who was the director of procurement when I went to the University of Michigan. Also just a wonderful guy, a pillar in our community. Bill Cooper, the current CPO for University of California, Office of the President. Just an amazing individual as well. Always has an open ear. Lots of amazing advice, and he has implemented just about anything you can imagine. So tons of lessons learned, an extremely humble person. Sue Webbert, who was the CPO for Stanford University. She's been retired several years now, but whenever I became the director at Michigan, she called me, and I had not met Sue in person. And she said, there aren't many women in this profession right now, Judy, and so I'm just reaching out to let you know that you're not alone. And that was like pretty amazing as well. And then, and then Ralph Meyer, University of Pennsylvania, CPO prior, I should say. He and I seem to always be in a friendly competition on strategic procurement and e-procurement. And I think he really helped to bolster me along as well. So maybe that was more than three.
That was a wonderful list. And I think that that's just proof to your point that there really are so many amazing people in this community. And they really are willing to help each other, because it's, for the most part, it's not a zero-sum game. So lifting somebody else up is helpful for everybody.
Right. I could probably list about seven other people, and I hope I haven't heard anyone's name.
I'm sure you have. Just if she didn't name you, she's thinking about you.
I am.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for today. Thank you so much for joining me, Judy. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Decisions That Matter. This podcast is brought to you by Procurated, the leading supplier evaluation tool for procurement. procurement professionals across the U.S. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you prefer to listen. See you again next time.